Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, have you heard the story about Aaron Burr's daughter, Theodosa? Did you know that she was shipwrecked off the coast? I mean, do you even remember who Aaron Burr was, the vice president of the United States? He was most famous perhaps because he shot Alexander Hamilton in a duel. But his daughter, Theodosa was extraordinarily beautiful, accomplished, important person, but who was shipwrecked off the coast of North Carolina during the War of 1812 and really never heard from again, except that she developed in legend. Some people say that she might have been taken in by the Outer Banks residents and became a part of that community, or that maybe she was killed by pirates or captured by pirates. All that is fact. Now she's part of a brand new novel called The Watery Part of the World. It's by Michael Parker, somebody whose gifts as a writer we've appreciated for a long time. And Michael has agreed to come by and talk about his new book and maybe a little bit about the real history of Aaron Burr, Theodosa, and the Outer Banks.
Certainly, as much as I know about it.
Michael Parker, well, I don't know where to begin, except that one of the things that fascinates me about writers is the relationship between short stories and novels. Mm-hmm. And some novelists say, never the twain shall meet. Others, like you in this one, get wrapped up in a short story and won't let it go. And you wrote a short story called Off Island. Off Island, right. Which was a part of a wonderful collection of short stories that Algonquin published not that long ago. And now that short story, it was the beginning of the novel The Watery Part of the World. How does a short story become a novel?
Well,
does that happen?
Sometimes, you know, it seems like the idea that you have is for a short story at the time, and you write it as a short story. And short stories really are about moments of illumination, as opposed to novels, which are about the effect of time upon character. And so sometimes you think that it's one thing, and that's actually what happened here, that I thought that story was really about one moment in the lives of these three people who were left on this island off the coast of North Carolina. But I never was satisfied by that story. I felt like it didn't work formally the way it should. I felt like the fates of the characters were not sufficiently dealt with.
Let me get you to do this. Talk about the short story and how what inspired you to write the short story? And that we're going to get at the, I mean, I'm trying to get at the novel, but I want to
do sure, it. The novel came out of the short story, really, and the Theodosia Burr thing that you've already mentioned. But I guess I was working down in Elizabeth City years ago as a writer in residence, and someone had told me about the last three people that lived on Portsmouth Island and how it was two elderly women and an elderly black man, and once they all got too old to, you know, take care of each other, they had to move off island. And that was pretty much the end of the island, right? I mean, because then it was taken
over. So we know Portsmouth Island, and it's still got the buildings are there. And,
yes. It's essentially, I mean, people say it's a ghost town, but it's not quite because it's maintained by the, as you know, have you been over there?
I haven't been there, but I feel like I've heard enough from Ocracoke's and then the people who come from the other direction up from
from Core Banks.
Yeah, from Cedar Banks, Cedar Island or something.
Right,
like that.
Yeah.
We hear about it. Yeah, but I mean, now I'm stuttering because I know I should have been there, but
right,
I haven't been there yet.
Well, you know, if you do go over there, the mosquitoes will call each other and they will descend upon you immediately. They're just waiting
I've heard about that.
Flesh. But so I'd heard about that story, and so I wanted to write it from the point of view of the black man because I was very interested in his, you know, why he stayed. What his relationship to that island was, what his relationship to these two sisters was, what happened when he decided not to be a part of that island anymore. And I thought it worked as a story, and it actually, you know, was published
the
in America.
You may not have been satisfied with it, but a lot of people thought it was great. And
it won a Pushcart Prize, which is a nice thing for
but
me.
But the thing that interested me, and I'm checking to see if I think this is that this is about this story is in about a lot of things, but about race and the idea that many of us are wrestling with this novel, The Help, and all the other things that go with it about what was it that bound serving black people to white people, and how the sort of class or categorizations bound people in a relationship that seems unbelievable.
Right.
So this black guy just sort of by habit was taking care of these two old white women.
In both the story and the novel, I think his motivation was less out of allegiance to taking care of these white women and more due his relationship to this place. And he understood, I think, that if he was going to stay on that island, then that was part of the deal, right? And his wife really wanted to leave the island, and he felt some connection to this place because that was where he was from and that was what he knew. That was his world. You know, and at one point, these guys called the tape recorders, who are oral historians, come down from Chapel Hill to record him, and they ask him what was it like, and you know, living there during the civil rights movement, and he says, you know, basically all I care about is if the fish are biting, because he lives in a place that's very isolated from everything else that's taking place in, you know, the 60s and 70s, whenever that part of the book was set, so. You know, the context for him is I get up every morning, I fish, I do whatever I have to do. I work in my garden, and, you know, taking care of these women and helping them out is just part of my staying on this island, my decision to stay on
this island. Is this your short story, or is this what you found out about this guy?
No, I don't know anything about the guy. You know, I hesitate even to say that it's Portsmouth Island, because I really, you know, it is, that's where I got the story, but the island in the book is completely different.
Well, I want to get back to the geography in a minute, because the geography challenges me. Mm-hmm. Your geography challenges
right.
me. But tell us, if you will, about the three characters, and you can – they're sort of the same in the novel and the short story, but focus on the short story just to flesh it out. You got three people living on an island
right.
together.
Yes.
Two complicated, older white women who've lived special lives, and then this black guy who's also complicated in a way – Who are they?
Well, I think I want him to be the most complicated character. I mean, I think
What's his name?
His name is Woodrow Thornton, and I think the thing about him is that there's a big discrepancy between the way that he's seen by, say, Whaley, who's the older of the sisters, and the more sort
she's
of.
She's about what? How old? About 65, 70.
I'm not so good at math, DG, I swear. I think she's, I mean, it moves from time, and moves
right,
across
right,
in time,
right.
But I think when the story ends, she's probably in her late 70s. And most of the action takes place, you know, like when Woodrow's wife is killed in the hurricane, I think she's probably in her 50s.
Yeah, okay.
So it basically, the story focuses on their lives from maybe, you know, their middle age until the time that they have to go off island. Woodrow, I think, is seen by her as a very sort of simple man. And that is, you know, part of what galls him, because he's actually very sensitive and very complex, and he has a highly developed inner life and a highly developed sense of right and wrong. And he's a very emotionally attuned person, but yet he can't show that side of himself, because that's not what, you know, that was the whole thing about, that's the whole thing about racism, is that you assume that people who are other than you are not capable of the same sort of emotional resonance and depth that you are. And that's certainly true in this novel with the older sister, Whaley, but her younger sister, Maggie, senses that in Woodrow. I mean, she thinks that he actually understands her and she can talk to him, and she thinks he's a good listener, but she still doesn't completely get him, right? Which is why the story's told from all three points of view, because I wanted the reader to understand that even though a lot of times the same material is covered, like there's several scenes that all three of the characters tell in their parts of the stories. But I wanted it clear that Woodrow had a more complex understanding, or as complex an understanding of what was going on, than either of the sisters, even though they didn't realize that he saw the things he saw.
We're visiting with Michael Parker, talking about his new book, The Watery Part of the World, and he and I'll be right back after this short break. Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square. It's locally owned, high-end shops and restaurants, and free parking on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. See you there.
Now, once again, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Michael Parker, who teaches writing at University of North Carolina in Greensboro, is the author of, I think now, five books of short stories. One of North Carolina's literary stars, and Michael greatly appreciated everywhere, especially across the street over here at Algonquin Books, where you have a great relationship. And all these things I want to talk about, but I want to keep on talking about the characters in your book, the key characters, and three of them. You've told us about the older, complex, apparently simple, though simple, black guy, mm-hmm. who is living on the island with this island off the coast of North Carolina with two middle-aged to older white women, mm-hmm. and the relationship. Now, you're talking about how Maggie, the younger of the older sisters, sees Woodrow,
right.
The black guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Maggie, I think, understands him a little more than her older sister, because her older sister, Whaley, just wants him to be who she thinks he is. It's easier for her. But I think that's the same. She feels the same way about her sister, that she's very cut and dried. She has a very black and white vision of the world, and she does not like anything to surprise her. Whereas Maggie is a lot more emotionally attuned to things and willing to take risks, but ultimately cannot leave the island because she's just too indoctrinated to that life and to what she would give up if she left there, which would be some sense of containment and some sense of identity. And I think the book really finally is about those three people's relationships and also Theodosia's relationship to the island, not only as a place, a specific place with dirt and wind and water, but also just as, you know, a part of themselves. So it seems to me that the book, or I hope that people understand that the book is really about the choices that we make in order to stay who we are, or to change, or to, you know, shift in some different direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, the idea about the ability to change gets to be kind of the key nut, and mm-hmm. it's a puzzling nut for the reader. And I think you mean for it to be a little bit of that there's no easy answers in there. But I wish you would talk about it, because these are aging. If we can't figure out exactly how old they might be, but they're aging people. They're getting old. And the a tough point in the book comes up when there's a reference to Woodrow being sort of too old to change. And that resonates with all three characters. Mm-hmm. Why? As an older person now, mm-hmm. and recognizing that it's tougher for me to change than it was when I was younger, why is it kind of a back-breaking time when these people say to each other, "You're too old. You can't change. You're too old to change." What makes that such a tough thing? And why is that such a
Well, I think it's particularly timely for them, because everything else is changing around them, and the island itself has changed because it's been hit by so many storms that, you know, what used to make it a viable place to live, which was its harbor and its, you know, the ability for ships to get there and make it a port, is no longer possible because of nature. And because of the inlet has shifted, you know, they would have to dredge it in order to get the ships in. So the whole kind of economic reason to live on that island has long since gone. So that the island is always changing. it's always being carried away by wind, and there's always been, it's always being replenished. So that, you know, that's kind of a metaphor for the way in which these people are faced with, you know, how can I evolve? How can I change? The world around me has changed. What do I do? Do I adapt, or do I just hold my ground? Do I just stay here? And I mean, a lot of that is true also between the sisters, because they just have such hugely different ways of seeing the world. You know, I mean, Maggie believes in love, a flawed, crazy, passionate love that brings her great sadness in the end. But she risks it. And her sister won't go there. She doesn't believe that that's the way you should behave, you know. So
but each of them, either of them, any of them, willing to embrace change?
I think in their own ways, perhaps. You know, Maggie at least goes off the island, even though she is a disaster. Woodrow is willing, in a sense. I mean, he goes down to the other end of the island when he's convinced that Sarah has made that place for him, and then he ends up coming back. I mean, everybody changes in the ways that they can.
Why then is Woodrow so angry, I guess, when it's said that he is too old to change?
I just think no one wants to be told they're too old to change. I certainly don't want to. I mean, I think it's, you know, I meant for it to strike a nerve in every reader, really, because I think when you say to someone, you cannot change, you know, and as a novelist, this is a dilemma that you face all the time. I mean, essentially, to be a writer, to be a fiction writer, you have to believe on some level that people are capable of change, because novels, stories are about the fact that people's, you know, even slightly, they shift. Their psychic place shifts or something. So, you know, this is a question both at the heart of story making, storytelling, and also at the in the way we live our lives, because, you know, no one wants to be told that they're incapable of change, but it's hard to change the way you see the world. It's really difficult. I mean, it calls for a concerted makeover, as they say these days.
So many of us, if we're really challenged, could get, like Woodrow did, very upset with people who accuse him of, if we're accused of being so set in our ways that we can't make a change.
Yes, I think so. I mean, this is my personal.
I'm not going to say that to you.
Well, I'm about to ask you what you would think if someone said you were too old to change.
I think you got a real good point, because my wife, but I recognize intellectually that I am incredibly set in my ways, uh-huh. and that it's very hard for me to make changes for the better. That is to get out of a messy office piled up with, you know, useless stuff that I can't throw away. I can't. Mm-hmm. And every morning I'd say, I wish I could change and just throw it all out, but I can't. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm locked into it.
Well, that's a pretty benign example, T.G.
It gets to be pretty desperate when you can't when you can't move. Or, you know, you're a hoarder. Mm-hmm. You think of it. I'm saying I've just got a mess. Well, you'd take a look at it. You would say, D.G., you're a hoarder. Uh-huh. You know, you need to get on TV.
Oh, you
can
be on the TV show?
Yeah. And then get fixed. And then somebody says to me, I recognize that. I understand that. And then somebody comes to me and says it in a kind of hard way. You just can't change. Well, that does. I see what you mean. That I intellectually accept it, but I sure don't like other people, you know, pointing it out.
Well, I think it's also about rectitude. I mean, especially the older sister, Whaley, she just thinks she's right. I think I've talked about this in other books as well. It seems to be something that I'm always struggling against, probably because when I recognize in myself this sense that I'm right and someone else is wrong, and that my view of the world is the right way, I get very troubled by that, because I would like to believe that I'm more flexible and that mm-hmm. I'm more open-minded. And so, you know, this story in particular, I think that idea is very present, because you can't be wrong. I mean, you can't be right or wrong when you're in a place that nature, that's subject to the winds and to the tide and to the, you know, to the water. I mean, there's no wrong or right about it. You just have to go with whatever the wind and water brings you. So you have to be adaptable to stay in that place. And that was a kind of metaphor for the larger ways in which we must adapt to life in order to thrive.
We're visiting with Michael Parker about his new book, The Watery Part of the World, and we're talking about, I think, the crux of the novel, but there's a more interesting side of it when he brings in the history and of Theodosia Burr Alston, a dramatic figure from history and legend. And after we take a short break, we'll talk a little bit about that part of the book. Michael Parker and I will be right back. Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill, University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Michael Parker is my guest. Many of us who follow North Carolina writing know pretty much about Michael Parker. He teaches writing over at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and his books and short stories are admired by his colleagues in the writing community and by a large group of fans. This book, the part that we talked about the characters and the interesting and complex relationships between these three major characters is fun. I love history, and I love, you know, like many North Carolinians, I love the Outer Banks, and anytime you can talk about pirates and Virginia Dare and all of this stuff, I'm happy. Mm-hmm. So you have set out to make me happy in your book by adding a layer of history onto the story that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about
it. I did it for you, D.T.
Thank you.
You're
is that
welcome.
All you got to say?
No, actually, it makes me happy, too, because I'm kind of obsessed with, like, especially Virginia Dare. I mean, I actually worked on a novel for years about the Lost Colony, not a historical novel necessarily, but about a guy who was obsessed with the Lost Colony. So, yeah, and that book was like 500 pages, and I never published it. So the little bit of Virginia Dare that you see in this novel, which is what, about two or three pages?
Yeah, yeah.
Is actually the boiled down essence of a 500.
Cut it.
Right.
Well, it's but the substitute for Virginia Dare is someone who disappeared, but through legend lives on because of, I don't want to say imaginary, but possible circumstances in which she might have survived and lived and become a part of the a population of North Carolina, and that her genes are still in our gene pool in North Carolina. So
right.
Theodosia, you've made Theodosia into a Virginia Dare-like figure, and you did it deliberately, didn't you?
Yes. I mean, I'm interested in just how important that little strip of land is for the larger sort of cultural implications of what happens when people disappear. Like, it's very strange to me that the first white, not strange, but interesting, that the first white child born in America disappeared and was sort of swallowed up by the continent. And then Theodosia, who's, you know, so she's interesting because of her father, but she's also, in her own right, an interesting person.
Tell us, before we get into the book, tell us about the facts about Theodosia. Although among pockets of North Carolinians and South Carolinians, she's, you know, well-known and legended, but many of us just
She's much wider known. I mean, I'm constantly running into people who've read the book who say, well, you got this wrong. Because here's what I knew about her. I knew that she was Aaron Burr's daughter. I used to read, when my daughter was much younger, I would read to her from a book called Myths and Legends of North Carolina. I think John Harden wrote that. He wrote a series of books with ghost stories and myths and legends. And Theodosia's story was in there. But it was only about the fact that she was traveling from Charleston back up to New York by ship to reunite with her father, who was coming back from London, who had been after his exile. And the ship disappeared. And then there were various, you know, theories of what happened to her afterward, and one of which involved a doctor from Elizabeth City being summoned to the Outer Banks to treat an older woman who lived off by herself in a shack, and she paid him with a portrait because that's all she had. And then he took it back over to Elizabeth City, and years later someone discovered that it was a portrait of Theodosia. So that was the story that I knew. And that's
that you heard when you were in Elizabeth City.
Well, I read in this book, and so I was interested in that. And because I lived in Elizabeth City, that was another connection. And then I did some research on her and found out that she was married to the governor of South Carolina, and that Aaron Burr is, in his own right, just deeply fascinating. You know, very, very, very able, intelligent statesman. And also kind of a whack job. I mean, he tried to take over Mexico. He got together this band and was going down the Mississippi to declare himself the emperor of Mexico. I mean, there were other things about his personality that were a little dubious.
Yeah, well, we find out that the borderline between being a successful politician and a wacko is. Well, it's an easy border to cross over.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, look, Theodosia was married to the governor of South Carolina, which we understand is still kind of a risky proposition to this day.
Yeah. Well, Theodosia went to the Outer Banks, and the recent governor of North Carolina just went to the western part of our state.
Exactly.
They all seem to wind up in North Carolina.
Right. Yeah. So I pretended
to be in the western part.
On the Appalachian Trail. Yeah, I didn't know that much about her, but I was really interested in I didn't want to know too much about, you know, what people speculated happened. I just wanted to reinvent what happened to her.
Come to the decision to affix the Theodosia story to the story of these two older white women and the older black man, the last to leave a North Carolina Outer Banks island?
Okay, first I wrote a 100-page novel start of a novel about Theodosia, and it was really dreadful. I mean, it was just maybe one of the worst things I've written, and that's saying a lot because I've written a lot of bad stuff. You know, we all have. You know, I mean, I've never written anything historical. Well, I've written a lot of stuff set in the 50s, but since I was born in the 50s, I don't know if that quite counts. But I could not get the language right, and it sounded as often happens when you're writing stuff that's not set in the time that you're living. Stilted, formal, just bloodless. There was no life in the prose whatsoever. And then I rewrote it again, and I went for a very sort of lyrical, mood. So, and I was trying to – the model for it was a book by Jean Rhys called Wide Sargasso Sea, which is a prequel to Jane Eyre. So I was interested in that book, which is a beautiful book, and in telling a story about something that happened, you know, before. So I kind of went back and wrote her early life before, you know, she got shipwrecked. And that didn't work either. And so I put all that aside, and then I wrote this novella based on these three people on the island, because as I said earlier, I wasn't actually satisfied with it as a short story, and I thought there was more to it. And that didn't work either because it needed something else. And often, you know, stories or novels are almost always, from my perspective, two different things that you've spliced together that aren't necessarily the same story. But when you splice them together, it provides a lot of energy. There's some sort of combustion, thematic combustion that occurs. So I realized that I had this other thing about Theodosia, and I had these three people that were set on the Outer Banks. I realized that what they had in common was the Outer Banks, but not the same island necessarily, because Theodosia's ship obviously, you know, washed up on Diamond Shoals, which is much farther north than where these people were. So I just started writing chapters going back and forth between the two and putting them together. And then at first, the structure was that they didn't really have anything to do with each other, but that they were sort of telling stories, parallel stories, but they never quite met. And they only met thematically. And then I realized that wasn't going to work, so I made the people on the island in the contemporary times descendants of Theodosia, right? So that I would have more of a connection between the two different sides.
And another descent. You made the African-American guy. a descendant of a freed or slave, enslaved, sort of, but free servant of Theodosius.
That came very, very late.
And how did that work?
I think I needed to shore up Woodrow's connection to the past. And the tape recorders, when they come, they think that Woodrow, or they trace Woodrow back to slavery, when in fact that's not true, right? So I wanted that discrepancy to be in there because often history is not true.
Oh, that's right. Well, there's so many interesting facets to this, and I don't want to get too much on the inside track, but one of the things that we love about the Outer Banks is the way people talk down there, and you you have a set of, I would just say, minor characters who are called the tape recorders. This is an academic person who's interested in language and interested in history. He goes down and tape records these people. But where did these, what role do the tape recording people play in this book?
Well, I think they play a hugely important role, and I didn't really realize this as I was writing it, but essentially, you know, everyone tells their own story, but it's not the story that you would get if the tape recorders came, right? But we think of oral history as being true, right, as opposed to
written history. Right, yeah, right. But
I think that, I'm an academic myself, so I'm not going to bash academia, but I do think that, you know, a lot of times you go, everything has to do with the questions that you ask and how you ask them. So you might think that you're getting the truth because you're just quote unquote letting people talk, but by virtue of what you ask them, and just like this interview, you know, you have certain things that you want.
Me the story you think I want to hear?
That's my point. I'm telling you my story. Yeah. Of course, you're shaping the interview by choosing to talk about certain things over other things, and that's all I was trying to say is that the real story, you know, the hardship, the beauty, the love, the passion that these people feel. Goes by the wayside because what the tape recorders want them to talk about are things that are concerned with the past and things that they've already decided are true. Like, this is the accent and this is where it came from. And it's the hoi-toi thing and that's who these people are. And, they have a very restricted view of the world and, you know, they wanted to act like Woodrow had never been off island when, in fact, he'd lived all over the, you know, eastern seaboard.
Yeah, I love this, but this I'm interested more than in the novel about how you came to these feelings about the tape recording or the oral history gatherers who love to focus on the Outer Banks because and the language. I mean, did that just come in from reading the newspapers about these things, or did you had an actual experience in oral history gathering?
No, I think it's. You know, it's not too far from what I'm doing as a writer, which is, I can never finally get at these characters' true stories. You know, it's only what I put on the page and it's the way I phrase them and it's the way I structure the novel that gets at what they think is the truth or what I think is the truth about them. So, in a sense, it's, you know, someone asked me this, it shocked me that they said, "Are you the tape recorder? Do you identify yourself most with a tape recorder?" My immediate reaction was no, because what they're doing is, they think they're getting at the truth, but they're really not. But then I began to think about it, and it does make sense that as the author, you know, I'm asking questions and I'm placing things in a certain order.
Oh, well.
That, you know, that leaves a kind of discrepancy between what the reader sees as the truth and what these people are saying. So, in a sense, I'm in the same position as these tape recorders.
I don't want to stop. We got to take a break, though. Visiting with Michael Parker about his new book, The Watery Part of the World. He and I will be right back. Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square. It's locally owned, high-end shops and restaurants, and free parking on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. See you there.
Now, once again, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Michael Parker is our guest. He teaches writing at UNC Greensboro and is such a highly regarded author. And I don't want to talk any more about him because I want him to talk about parts of his book. The Watery Part of the World is about a lot of things. And it's very little about the pirates on the North Carolina Outer Banks. But one of the meanest things you did was to destroy, for me, the romanticism of the people who lived on the Outer Banks in the early days, because you made them not just people who gathered up the shipwrecks, but people who – and not just people who every now and then would put a false light out that might guide a ship into the banks so that they would have something else to harvest. But you turned these Outer Bankers in the early 1800s into – mean, vicious people who not only took the ships, but they killed the people on the ships. And there's this horrible person, Daniels, and Daniels is Outer Banks' name to this day as the lead pirate. Now, is that history, or did you just make that up?
I totally made that up. I mean, it's my job to entertain.
Well, you did. I mean, it was wild. I mean, these are pirates who just making people walk the planks and gutting them, cutting their heads off, all these things.
It's I don't think you want a pirate who's going to, you know, sit down and read the, you know, sing Kumbaya to you.
I mean, I know, and these are pirates who didn't even have a ship. You know, they were land-based. They were marauders, and you got the whole notion that the Outer Banks, that the political government of the Outer Banks was just, it was like Somalia. It was all made up, right?
Totally made up. And I certainly don't want to offend anyone in the Outer Banks by suggesting that all their ancestors were marauders. But, you know, I feel like if you're going to have a pirate in your book, then you might as well go whole hog. You know, I mean, I had a hard time with that because I didn't want to write, like, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I didn't want to write, a peg leg guy with a parrot on his shoulder saying, you know, hoisting a tanker of ale always and saying ahoy. But I wanted there to be a sense of danger and threat for Theodosia because, you know, so much of what happens is her trying to straddle a line between appearing sane and being sane and then acting, you know, insane so that they will save her, so that there had to be some cost and some threat. Something that she would have to pay if she didn't keep, you know, in these people's good sights.
Well, it made me think this description. I don't want to make too much of this in the book. I don't know how important it was to you, but it grabbed hold of me. You did entertain and then terrified me about this, and I thought, good golly, these good old Outer Bankers, they're more like Mexican drug lords than they are about my version of the simple acts of collecting shipwrecks versus making the shipwrecks and being a pirate. But if you're a pirate, you're a terrorist. And if you're living under that kind of regime, then it's different from a New England democracy.
Well, Blackbeard was not a nice guy. I mean, he was not. I mean, there's a lot of – I've read a bunch of stuff. And this is obviously not Blackbeard because it's 100 years later. And it's a very different kind of thing. And in fact, there wasn't much piracy in the Outer Banks during the time that I'm talking about. So, I mean, I had totally changed that just because I'm a fiction writer and I can do what I can do whatever I want. I mean, it doesn't have to be historically accurate. But, I mean, you read about those pirates. I mean, it's tough. And especially if you live in a place where there's not much. I mean, it's not an agrarian society. It's not like you can just, you know, plant corn. I mean, what are you going to do? How are you going to – I mean, how many boiled terns can you eat? You know, you have to figure out a way to survive. And so it's exaggerated, I agree with you, and probably maybe a little bit too much. But on the other hand, it's exaggerated for a reason because I wanted to get in that section as well how difficult it is to live in that place and the kind of measures that people would go to in order to stay there.
Well, we have not talked enough about Theodosia. The Michael Parker version of Theodosia. And I guess since we're just about out of time, I have to say, read Michael Parker's book, The Watery Part of the World, and you'll be introduced to a totally fictional Theodosia, but one who's incredibly interesting and resilient, and one who you can even think, as I did, starting out thinking there would be no way that if Theodosia had wound up on the Outer Banks, she wouldn't have just run on across the Sound and gone to Norfolk and gone home, mm-hmm. but that this woman would stay, that something grabbed her, and that she would stay even if she had the opportunity to go mm-hmm. home. So great, great story, Michael Parker.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Michael Parker for this book and for stopping by Chapel Hill to share it with us. And, of course, thanks to all of you all for listening. Who's Talking? If you're not satisfied with Who's Talking as you're hearing it now, you can always listen to a version of Who's Talking every 7 days a week at 9 o'clock when we rebroadcast some of our best programs from the past. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and I'll be right back here soon.